I'm tryna get out my head. Plug in the mic and leave nothing unsaid. Now sit back, relax, and listen to some real talk.
Now sit back, relax, and listen to some real talk.
You are now listening to Unspoken Words Podcast.
Unspoken Words.
Episode 182. The universe is urging you to focus on your thoughts and emotions to manifest your desire. Episode.
Manifest. Who can know what?
Rose on point today.
Manifest.
And no more.
Manifest.
What was that? Manifest. Who can you name? In no way, your name.
I was trying to be a backup singer there.
My bad. I missed that cue. Must have been the sausage.
Just left him hanging.
Oh man,
I must said something bad. Chill.
Yeah, keep it PG-13. PG-13. Hey, Unspoken Words, the triads back in the house in episode 182. And over here to my left, all the way from Jesus, number 83 in the place to be, is the Pod Guardian. He ain't even trying to preach. Randy B, say showed up.
Mahalo.
Marshmallow.
Mahalo, bro. Those lonesome Yodi nights. And over here to my right, all the way from Babu Nino, he is your favorite Indian. JCB, JC Shooter McGavin. Your hole in one, your ace. Say showed up.
Hoka hey.
It's a good day to die, little big man. Little horse. Hey, tonight, and special guest tonight across the way from me tonight, Wayne Daigle, MSLCPC, the bringer of the sausage.
Yeah.
I will explain that a little bit more. Say showda, say hello.
Okay.
Iksugapi. That means it chick, right? Yep. Means good.
Good.
All right. Right on. Yeah, we're going to get into the story a little bit later, but
hey,
you know me, Mo Hugs Not Jugs, all the way from up the road in Arrow Creek. Hey. There's Karen. I want to hear Karen. Bring out Karen. Come here, girl. Come here. Yeah, there's my horse Karen right there, looking all beautiful.
Yeah,
trying to be all shacked up on the res with a res horse.
Oh,
I had to go get her back. It's active season, so I had to get her out.
Chase her down.
She's trying to be all somehow with a res horse out there. Didn't even have his front teeth. I think she kicked him out. I don't know.
All scrawny and just rib showing.
Yeah. All mangy teeth.
Mangy. Cockabers in the mane.
Yeah, cockabers in the tail.
Cockabers in the tail.
I said, what are you doing with him? Come on, let's go home.
Hey.
So I got some fresh apples for you. All right, so you guys ready for some dad jokes or what's up?
Yes, sir.
All right, here we go. Man, this is like way at the bottom. I don't know if I have enough data for this. Just kidding. After an unsuccessful harvest, why did the farmer decide to try a career in music? Any guesses?
Uh-uh.
Because he had a ton of sick beats. I only seem to get sick on weekdays. I must have a weakened immune system. I thought that was going to be a...
I thought, too.
My friend was showing me his tool shed and pointed to a ladder. That's my stepladder, he said. I never knew my real ladder. Why is it so cheap to throw a party at a haunted house?
Huh.
Because the ghosts bring all the booze.
That's all right. That's all right. Yeah, okay.
All right. We'll give you that one.
I don't get why Marvel doesn't use the Hulk to advertise more. He's basically one big banner. What brand of underwear do scientists wear?
Fruit of the Loom?
Nope.
Hanes?
Calvin Klein.
Oh, yeah. Okay, okay.
Why is that?
Because of the Kelvin.
Kelvin, okay. Unit of measurement.
Okay.
It's,
not I never Calvin. Knew that.
Temperature. They got the spicy sausage.
Oh, yeah, side note. Wayne here brought us some antelope jalapeno or smoked antelope jalapeno sausage.
Oh, it's smoked?
Yeah.
Jalapeno cheddar roll.
Heck yeah, man.
So we're gonna tear into that later.
Cheddar roll, but for some reason they keep referring us to as a sausage.
Yeah, I don't know. I like that cheddar roll idea. Of course, I dated her in high school, but
yeah, you too, huh? You too.
Man, got around. I just found out I'm colorblind. The news came out of the purple. Which days are the strongest? Any guesses?
Weekends?
Friday.
Saturday and Sunday.
Yes. Saturday and Sunday, the rest are weekdays.
Yeah, I saw that one coming.
Did you know your pupils are the last part to stop working when you die? They dilate.
That's so stupid. It's funny.
Oh, my wife asked me the other day where I got so much candy. I said, I always have a few tricks up my sleeve. How do cows stay up to date?
Stay up to date?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
They read the newspaper.
Somebody's got to like that.
What's the difference between a well-dressed man on a unicycle and a poorly dressed man on a bicycle?
Their attire?
Yeah, attire.
Oh, okay.
Double entendre, as Randy would say. I hate my job. All I do is crush cans all day. It's so depressing. Where do pirates get their hooks?
I don't know.
Secondhand stores.
That funny.
They're fake laughing. Okay, here we go. Of all the inventions of the last 100 years, the dry erase board has to be the most remarkable.
Kind of on the fence with that.
In America, using the metric system can get you in legal trouble. I don't know.
Say it again.
In America, using the metric system can get you in legal trouble.
Legal trouble. You get that?
I'm not picking that one up either.
I don't know.
Someone out there is laughing their head off right now.
I know. Some European.
Yeah,
some
it's not a native joke at all.
No. What do you call a line of men waiting to get haircuts? a barbecue.
Oh, Q. Yeah, like you're in Q.
Huh? A barber.
Oh. Yeah, I'm with you on that one.
In fact, if you sneer at any other method of measuring liquids, you may be held in contempt of court.
I get that one. All right. You got me back.
Who were the greenest presidents in U.S. history?
The greenest?
Mm-hmm.
The ones on the money.
The Bushes.
That's a good one. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
My hotel tried to charge me $10 extra for air conditioning. That wasn't cool. What do you call a beehive without an exit?
I don't know.
Unbelievable. If you ever find the doctor who screwed up my limb replacement surgery, I'll kill him with my bare hands.
Limp replacement?
Limb?
Oh, limb.
Yeah, see, I missed the B on the first go around, too.
Yeah.
I was thinking, where are we going?
Yeah, I don't know.
Doctor doing limp work? What?
Limb.
Limb. That was limb. My bad.
I'll kill you with my bare hand. Oh! Oh, okay.
Like, it's just your hand.
Yeah.
Because it's not a limb there.
I find it funny that we have to explain this to ourselves.
I know. Did you know that the first French fries weren't cooked in France?
They weren't?
They were cooked in Greece.
I should have known that. I should have known that. Damn it.
This morning, Siri said, "Don't call me Shirley. I accidentally left my phone in airplane mode."
I get it. I get it. That's all right. Nah. You got to know the movie.
Yeah, you got to be like from the 70s. Didn't that movie come out way back then?
Yeah, it's old.
Yeah, it's an old one.
It's easy to convince ladies not to eat Tide Pods, but harder to detergents.
You wanted it?
I asked my date to meet me at the gym, but she never showed up. I guess the two of us aren't going to work out.
Ooh. Oh, that's... Yeah.
Yeah. That's what Randy would call a double entendre.
Yeah.
Yeah. How do you find Will Smith in a snowstorm?
Slap him.
Now you talk about his wife.
Oh.
Is that really a dad joke?
No, it says you look for fresh prints.
Oh.
I liked yours better, though. We'll give it that.
The difference between a numerator and a denominator is a short line. Only a fraction of people will understand this.
Mm.
I get it. Mm-hmm. I get it.
Four out of three people get it.
Mm-hmm.
I found a wooden...
Four out of three people?
You guys just got that one on.
That was a delayed reaction. I found a wooden shoe in my toilet today. It was clogged.
Four out of three people.
Four out of three people get that joke.
Study show.
That's stupid. Research suggests.
Yeah.
I just broke up with my mathematician girlfriend. She was obsessed with an ex.
Mm.
She must have taught algebra. I can't take my dog to the pond anymore because the ducks keep attacking him. That's what I get for buying a purebred dog.
Ah, purebred.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
What's Forrest Gump's password?
Oh, you said this one before.
I know.
Run, Forrest, run.
I think that's what I said last time, too.
Close. One, Forrest, one.
Okay. One, Forrest, one. Yeah.
Still a stinker.
I used to run a dating service for chickens, but I was struggling to make hens meet. If prisoners could take their own mugshots, they'd be called cell fees. If a pig loses its voice, does it become disgruntled? All right, just a couple more. They're getting too dry. What do you call a bundle of hay in a church?
A pew.
No. No. Christian Bale.
Oh, Christian Bale. Okay. Okay.
A ship carrying red paint and a ship carrying blue paint collided in the middle of the ocean. Both crews were marooned.
You know what? That one didn't work.
Huh?
4 out of 3 people don't know the primary colors. 4 out of 3 people can't mix colors.
Have you heard about the restaurant on the moon?
No.
Great food, no atmosphere. I don't trust stairs. They're always up to something. Never date a tennis player. Love means nothing to them.
Okay, we got one.
That was another one of those stupid ones that were funny.
Yeah.
4 out of 1 people like that.
All right, last one. What did Yoda say when he saw himself in 4K?
I don't know.
HDMI.
All right. Okay, that was
a good ending. Yeah, that was a good one.
I seen that, and I was like, this is where we end it. This is where it ends.
That you're going to say Yoda lay.
Yoda lay. Shoda lay, vato.
Shoda Yoda.
Right on, man. How are you guys feeling? You feeling warmed up?
Yes, sir.
Ready to do this? About you, Mr. Dago. You ready to go?
Yes, sir.
All right, all right, all right, all right. So, DJ, if you're ready, why don't you hit me with that beat?
Yo, let's get into our topic. Yo, let's get into our topic.
All right, we're here in the main topic. We got Mr. Dago MSLCPC in the hot seat, and I'm going to throw it over here to your favorite Indian. Take it away.
So, first of all, thank you for being here this evening. It's an honor to have you. And, you know, why don't you just give a little bit about your background? You know, tell us what we're working with here.
Okay. Well, thanks for having me. It's an honor to be on here and get to share some of my stuff. So I grew up on the Blackfeet Reservation out on what they call Seville Flats. My mom still lives on the same farm that I grew up on. My brother just bought a place next to her, so the family's still out on the res.
Right on.
Which is cool. And I'll, you know, as we go along I get in more detail. Let's give you the high view right now. So in 96, I was involved in a motor vehicle accident, and that's what brought me down to Billings. I went into Voc Rehab, and they put me through school here. It was really interesting. They did an IQ test on me, and they found out that I was fairly smart,
I know.
Which was a surprise to me because, you know, as a as a res boy, you don't get told you're smart very often.
Yeah.
No.
So it was really, that was kind of an eye opener for me. And I got down here, started school and finished with a, I did a bachelor's degree in rehab and related services and extended major option in special ed. So I kind of had that rehab piece and then the special ed part, which ended up working out really well because when I met my wife, she had our oldest boy is autistic and he just got diagnosed autistic.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really, beneficial, real lifetime. So that was good. And then, you know, I ended up going to work out at the Boys and Girls Ranch and that lasted about 13 months and I burnt out. And I got on with Montana Voc Rehab. And so I spent the next, you know, 8-10 years with them, 12 years, I can't remember. I'm not a good mather. That's why I talk to people.
Okay.
So, but then I got, you know, I got to be the tribal liaison with the Northern Cheyenne Tribe and the Crow Tribe. And that was cool because I was out traveling around with the res and serving people with disabilities. And then I got an opportunity to be a director of the Northern Cheyenne Tribal VR program while I was a state counselor. And that was a really cool experience. And I got to learn state, federal, and tribal policy and rules and all that fun stuff, which set me up to be in the position I'm in now. So now I have two pieces of work. My wife will say that I got about 7 jobs, but you know I only claim 2.
Yeah.
And I'm the owner of the Perspectives Counseling and Consulting here in Billings. And then I'm during the day, I'm the director of the American Indian Vocational Rehabilitation Training and Technical Assistance Center.
Okay. Mm,
right. Yee, just by the name, you know it's a federal program, right? Yeah, you got to stop and take a breath. We call that AVRTAC. And so AVRTAC supports all the tribal VR programs. And there's currently 93 projects in 26 states. And we're serving right around 170 different tribes.
Whoa.
Dang.
So then the consulting part is I focus a lot of my training on trauma, generational trauma, historical trauma, the historical mistrust, and then PTSD and CPTSD, because I kind of see them all, you know, welding together and affecting a lot of our people. And that's where Josiah met me, and he came to a training, and then we just kind of hooked up, and that's how I got the invite here. He thought I was real pretty standing up there, so he's like, hey, you got to come hang out with us.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's why I brought that salami.
Oh, salami.
The cheddar roll.
Day old salami.
Smoked jalapeno cheddar roll.
Okay, so how about any contact with drugs and alcohol? I mean.
Yeah, so. You know, growing up on the res, it's right there all the way around you.
Yeah.
I didn't really get into any hard drugs. I've never done any drugs. I think like the most the closest I've come was mini thins back in the day.
Oh yeah.
You take like 13 of them, your hair grows.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's so. It's low grade speed, right? So I've played around a little bit with that, but I never got into the hard drugs. But alcohol became my friend. You know, there was a lot of stuff happening when I was in middle school. My dad got toxic chemical poisoning, and he almost died. And that pressure, plus also, you know, the what I can recognize now as emotional abuse in my family, those two things combined really opened that door for me to start into alcohol. And at one point I was drinking. You know, I'd sneak out. I'd get drunk before school, sneak out at lunch, slam down a fifth and go back to class, drink at work after school. You know, those Zimas came out then. You guys remember Zima?
Yeah, I remember Zima.
Yeah,
man. Jolly Rancher, throw it in there.
No smell. It's awesome. You just get hammered at work, walking around drinking your deli cup full of Zima.
Ooh.
Yeah. Dang.
And so how old were you when you first started drinking?
You know, growing up branding and ranching, you know, you'd sneak in and steal beer out of the cooler So probably 8, 6, somewhere in there.
Okay.
Is when I first started nipping, and then I got real hard, like I said, freshman year, sophomore year, junior year. Senior year, I kind of sobered up. I wasn't using so hard then, but it was you know, senior skip day, so we'd all go drink together.
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah.
But it wasn't, at that point, I wasn't, you know, getting drunk in the morning or at noon.
You were saying that you had a motorcycle accident, or was it just a regular car accident?
Oh, in 96, I rolled a pickup. Okay. Yeah, so it was I rolled it 3.5 times. And I can go down that story. I mean, that story is...
For sure.
So I rolled a pickup. I was, there was 3 other people in the pickup with me. There's a total of 4, and it ranged from death to sprained ankle.
Oh, wow.
Mm. Yeah, so I went off the road, came back on. I was starting into the corrective steering and trying to get it back under control, and then the front tire blew out.
Oh, wow.
And that's where I degloved the left arm. So it was stuck between the highway and the roof, and it just kind of slid down, and just like a wood planer went in and took it off. You can see on the edge here how deep it was.
Yeah.
So I just had like a half inch of arm left.
Oh, wow.
Mm. So they went in and cleaned it up, and I can get into that story in a minute. So then at the same time, I was the first one to be ejected, and I went across all 3 people out the out the passenger window.
Okay.
Which is really weird, and I didn't really understand how all that worked, but it was a 73 Chevy, so it had the lap belts,
mm-hmm.
and there was 4 of us, so none of us had seat belts on.
Mm.
And it's one of the only accidents I've ever known that if I had the seat belt on, it would have killed me, because it would have just ripped me in half, the centrifugal force, because I was a big guy then, too.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of weight, you know, being thrown around. So as I went into that first roll, we had enough centrifugal force that I had a compression fracture of L2, and it drove the vertebrae into the spinal cord. And then as I was ejected, I was throwing, and I can't remember the numbers now, it was like 386 feet or something like that. And when I landed, I burst the spinal cord sac. Mm. And so the nerves came out, and the neurosurgeon said that it looked like a bowl of spaghetti when he opened me up to start working on me.
Oh, wow.
And so when the pickup quit rolling, it actually came back onto its wheels, and my feet and legs were underneath the pickup. So another half a roll, it would have killed me.
Wow.
And my buddy was on the other side. He was ejected. And as he came out, he either hit a piece of metal on the roof or he hit a reflector stake, and it cut him and shaved off the top of his hip.
Ooh.
And so as he was like walking around in shock, he was holding his intestines and everything up out of the dirt. That's how the ambulance found us. And there was a young boy, 12-year-old boy, that was killed in the accident. He was ejected as well, but he landed on the highway, and it just, you know, it was a open head injury. It killed him instantly.
Dang.
So yeah, that was a lot of fun. And here's the thing, as we talk about like psychology stuff and the psyche, your subconscious will shut down your conscious brain if you can't handle it,
mm-hmm.
whatever's going on in your life. So that's why, you know, we see like dissociative identity stuff. Mm-hmm. People, mm-hmm. they're getting such a massive amount of trauma that they can't process it. So they disassociate and create this identity that can. Well, with me, for some reason, I never lost consciousness. And I remember every aspect. So, like, wow. I watched the hood wrinkle and then the glass explode in front of my face when it came up to the windshield. And I remember rolling and getting ejected. I can honestly say I know what it feels like to fly.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, you know, the landing sucks. So, yeah, I went. And then with that, you know, I was mercy flighted out. They took me to Great Falls. I was in the hospital for 2.5 months. And the toughest part for me with that was the changing of the seasons. You know, I think if I hadn't have seen fall, winter, spring, you know, that type of thing, it wouldn't have been so bad. But went through the whole rehab process, learning how to walk, how to, you know, wipe my butt to feed my face, you know, everything.
Yeah.
Because at that point when I went in, I was a complete paraplegic. Mm-hmm. And as the inflammation and swelling went down, I started to have some recovery, and the label they gave me was an incomplete paraplegic.
Oh, wow.
Dang.
And that's kind of what catapulted you into your career now?
Yeah, so I met the first therapist I had was a traveling therapist, and that they would send him all over there, and then, you know, they pay for, like, his housing and give him a food allowance. And he had just came from Hawaii. He was on the Big Island, and his apartment was on the beach. So, like, he walked out his front door, walked down the beach to the hospital, and he was making, like, $100 an hour.
Dang.
As a traveling therapist, right? So yeah, I'm like, yeah. Sweet, I'm gonna be a physical therapist and do this. Mm-hmm. And I got out here and I started school, and my back didn't stabilize. So there's, you know, yeah. we had wanted to get some strengthening in, and it wasn't happening. Mm-hmm. And so I went into the advising office at MSU. I probably shouldn't say. Too late, man. MSU yeah, Billings.
Yeah.
And as I'm standing in the advising office, they looked at, I said, I need to find a new major. Can you help me? And they go, there's the wall with all the stuff. Go pick something. I'm like, really? Sweet. Okay. That's some good support.
Yeah.
And so as I'm scanning the wall, I see rehab counseling.
Mm.
And I thought, you know, I'm going through the rehab process. I understand it pretty good. And I like to screw with people's heads. Yeah, I always have. And I, you know, so I always screwed with people. So that's how I got on this career, and now I get paid to listen to people's story and screw with their head.
Yeah.
So it's awesome.
That's cool. What's the most important lesson that you learned over your career?
The most important lesson is that you're not important. Laugh at yourself. Mm. Uh-huh. You know, a lot of people start to take themselves real serious, and it starts to really bog them down, and you get wrapped up in what you should be and what you can be and how you should be acting and, you know, how does this profession see me or how does my coworker? And it doesn't matter. Yeah. As long as you're a good person and laugh and take care of your stuff and your family, like, you know, we all have roles. And I think, okay, I'm starting to stand on a soapbox here, but.
That's all good.
Come on. He ain't even trying to preach.
So, you know, we all, especially as Native men, we have roles. And our women have roles, and one of those roles is taking care of yourself and your people around you. So, you know, that's the most important thing I've learned so far is to, you know, not take it for granted and to just laugh. You're going to screw up. You're human. It's okay. You know, and just do the best. If it's with the best intention. And if you made the decision with all the information that you have at that time, and it's still a screw up, is it really a screw up? Because you did the best you could.
Yeah.
Kind of like a lesson learned.
Yeah.
Okay, now that we asked that, like, what's your biggest pet peeve then? Let's go.
Parents.
Okay.
Parents, yeah. So
damn
like
parents.
When I'm working with kids, especially, you know, there's the CPS involved youth a lot of times.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I found that I'm kind of on the short list sometimes for their phone calls because of my style, and they like how I interact with the youth, but they also like how I interact with the parents. And those parents that come in and they're like, oh, you know, I'm here to in the best interest of my kid. And then the kid's like, yeah, but last night when I got in trouble, you backhanded me.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, so I get, you know, spare the rod, lose a child type mentality. I grew up in it, mm-hmm. right? I'm Generation X, so last feral band, right? So I understand that, and there's some time and place for it, but if that's consistently how you handle every situation from a spilled glass of milk to a kid running in the street, right, there's a very big difference in severity.
Mm-hmm.
And then you try and talk to that parent, and they're like, no, I know what I'm doing. Well, okay, but obviously you don't, because there's a whole agency involved in your life from the choices you've made and brought your kid into. So we should probably talk about it. And when they choose not to talk to about it or to accept that there's something wrong, that's my pet peeve.
Right on, man. I definitely agree with that. They're like not willing to take an honest look at themselves. Mm-hmm. And they're just like, well, we just got to get jumped through these hoops so I can get my kids back.
Yeah.
Or whatever, yeah. You know.
I just got to check this list off.
Yep.
You know, when they start talking to me like that, then we have a bigger conversation.
Yeah.
You know.
No, that makes a lot of sense because it that kind of relates to recovery, right? Like being accountable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm and so my style, it's really interesting because there's not many people that I've seen that have my type of style. in their therapeutic approach. And it's really up in your face. Like, I'm not pushy, but I'm also not afraid to say, you know, bullshit.
Yeah.
You're not, you're what you're saying isn't true. You know, you just said this over here, and now you're saying this, and it doesn't match.
Mm-hmm.
So I get up in their face, and I like that accountability. You know, I hold myself strictly accountable for my actions, and when I'm sitting in a therapy session, my job is to not react to you, but to assess what's going on and find out what's making you tick, and then help you recognize the journey to resolve that issue, right?
Mm-hmm.
And everybody, whether we're talking, you know, people with addiction, or we're talking to people adjusting to disabilities, or we're talking recovery from trauma, everybody has something inside of them that's either blocking the process or they can't focus on it. And once we identify what that is, they have the answer. Everybody has the answer to the issues that they're presenting with. They just don't know how to see it. And so that's where we join up in that journey, and we just walk together on the path to find that resolution.
Mm.
So it's not me telling you what's wrong with you. It's like you going, oh, that's why I do that type situation.
Yeah, for sure.
It's kind of like that saying, like, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink, right? That's basically what you're doing is, like, you're leading. So, like, if I was your client, like, you would be leading me to the water so that I can get a drink. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we kind of set the path, you know, and like, I always tell my clients when I'm working with them is you control this. This is your session.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll go wherever you want to go, but I'm going to be here to kind of set up some markers. You know, we're not just going to talk about, you know, getting mad because you didn't get your ice cream cone.
Yeah.
Right? We're going to talk about when you got mad for not getting your ice cream cone, you punched your grandma in the face. Like, we're going to talk about that issue. Yeah. So I guide it. I provide some external structure to their exploration.
Right on.
That's good.
I know I've sat in your training before and we talked a lot of that was all like grief and trauma, mostly like trauma stuff. And then like we had this point where in the conference or like some people are like, I don't want to revisit it. I know that it happened and that's good enough for me for now. But can you talk about how just like addressing that trauma that happened, you know, with a professional, definitely, how liberating that is for individuals, even yourself, as you went through that process.
Yeah. So there's that's a that's always a hot debate, right? Yeah.
Uh-huh.
You're not going to make me go back. You're not going to make me look at it. Well, that's fine. You don't have to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
But there is you know, tons of research and tons of support for the thought process that at some point we have to look at it. Now, My approach with that is when I'm working with somebody and we've developed the rapport and the trust in the relationship, so it's 100% there. They trust what we're doing therapeutically together. We will start to delve into that trauma. And for me, it's just, I found the best approach is the direct approach, the straight approach. What's your trauma, right? So I worked with a gal, she had been raped. And so that was her trauma, right? The sexual abuse and rape.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and that's something that's kind of really interesting is with Native gals, they're comfortable with me. And the textbooks say that you shouldn't be comfortable with me.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason we connect and I do a lot of work with Native teenage and young women and, you know, all ages of women, Native population.
Aunties too?
Aunties. Please, that's another story. I got to be careful because my wife is going to be listening. So we aren't going to be talking about any teepee creeping or anything like that. But so when we're working at through that trauma, we go to that trauma. We talk about the event. Now, depending on the level of that individual's acceptance of the trauma or the situation or the fragility of their mental health, we might not go and just rip it wide open. But we're going to take that scab off, and we're going to talk, you know, about some of the feelings that go with that. Maybe I won't have her describe the event to me, at that point because she's not ready to go down that path.
Yeah.
But once people get to that point that they're comfortable and ready to go down the path, then I jump into it. We go right back to the incident. I want them. So where the trauma is housed in the brain, it's not a memory. It's a living experience. Mm. So when you go back to that trauma, you are experiencing the same emotions and feelings that you experienced at that moment, whether it's 5 minutes ago or 50 years ago. Mm. You feel that same active emotion and feeling. And so we go back to that event just so they can feel that. And we'll stop there and process through that emotion and start to package it up and put it away. And what I found is that it's very empowering for the individual when they go to that point. Mm-hmm. Because they get to take that control back of what they're feeling about that event. And through memory management, we start to package it and put it away so that we manage those emotions. The trauma never goes away.
Oh, yeah.
No, never. No. You know, it's always going to be active. It's always going to be present. We just learn how to manage those reactive feelings and the activating events better as we progress. So for me, you know, I didn't realize that I was that I experienced emotional abuse when I was growing up. Mm-hmm. I'd go to my dad's or my friend's house, and their dads would beat the shit out of them. Mm-hmm. Oh, I don't know if I should be cussing. Sorry.
No, you can cuss.
All right, cool. So
too fucking late now.
Yeah.
There's on the table. 4 out of 3 guests cuss on this.
So I'd go, you know, and their dads would beat them up. And I thought, oh, you know, my dad doesn't beat me, so we must be okay. And this is a normal family. And then as I got into college and stuff, that's when it started to really challenge my thinking and change some of my cognition. And I was about probably 31, I think 31 or 32. I just my whole world collided, and I attempted suicide. And luckily we were working on some other stuff, my wife and I, and we had a therapist already involved. So we, like, it happened on like a Sunday, and Monday we went into couples therapy. So we had immediate support we could process it. And, mm-hmm. And I remember that journey, recognizing that I had this trauma and how it shaped my thinking and how it shaped my behaviors. It was just incredible, but it gave me so many answers to why I felt the things I felt when I'd look at people and they would not have that same reaction. Mm. And then the toughest part was not listening and relearning everything from my viewpoint. That was so tough. Like, I remember we got out of therapy one time and we got in the car and we're driving down the road and this jingle comes on and I'm bawling. Like, I just break down. I'm alligator tears.
Yeah.
It was a freaking toilet paper advertisement. Come on. Like, I'm crying over ass wipe. Yeah. And I looked at my wife and I'm like, what is going on? She goes, it's emotions, and it's okay.
Yeah.
I never understood that it was okay to feel stuff like that.
Mm.
So, you know, that type of stuff, it's such an eye-opening experience, and it's such a challenge to decide, do I like the color blue, or was I told to like the color blue?
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
Do I like country music, or was I told to like it? So, there's a lot of journey in that and empowerment when you come out of it.
Liberating.
Yeah,
definitely. You were saying some terms, and I just kind of wanted you to define them and kind of unpackage them real quick. processing it, like processing emotions, like what is that? Like, what does that look like? What are you putting people through, or what did you have to do?
Processing is, you know, we go back to the basics. Like, so many. And I'm going to focus on Native men right now for a minute.
Yes.
So many Native males have never been told or taught what an emotion is. Mm. One, maybe we didn't have a present male figure in our life, or the male figures that we had in our life were, you know, drunk or high. And so we never got that teaching, okay? So we don't even know what the emotions are and what it means to feel. We're taught to be angry. We're taught to be horny. And we're taught to be hungry and to be happy. Mm-hmm. That's it. Those are the four main for men, right?
Yeah.
And if you're sad, doesn't matter. Put it away.
Throw some dirt on it.
Rub some dirt on it. It's a long ways from your heart. Just pull your bootstraps up and keep going.
Mm-hmm.
So we go back to the basics and we get like out the emoji or emotion chart, and it'll have every, all the emotions and the faces. And I'm like, so tell me what this means. What is this, what does this look like? And so we'll go all the way back and start defining some emotions for these guys and gals when I'm working with them at the same level. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then from there we start to build up and so we get the labeling done. Then we go to events. We start connecting to the events. Where does this label go with this experience? That type of thing.
Okay.
And with a lot of trauma, all of us that have lived in chaos and trauma, we start to ignore our body. That sixth sense, that we have, that's not a good situation to be in. Maybe we should be out of it. But when you're in chaos and in survival mode just to get up to get breakfast to go to school, you start to ignore that because that's the only way to function. And so we disconnect from our physiological response and reaction to danger so that we can survive. And so one of the things when I'm working with guys, especially again, one of my recommendations or treatment homework things is to go get a massage. And experience what good touch is. And to let somebody touch you. And there's guys that freak out. They're like, no, there's no way. I'm not going to go do that shit. The other thing I like to do is tell guys to go be the little spoon.
These guys.
The professional little spoon.
So it just helps people, they start to feel again. And they recognize that there can be a good feeling with this stuff that's happening. And so once we get all of that wraparound support, I don't know if I should say that with this group, but once we get all that holistic support, that's what I'm going to use.
Yeah.
then we start to see a lot of improvement. We see growth rapidly at that point because they're able to connect all the dots. I mean, the emotional state is working with the physical state, and you're kind of really starting to come back into that wise mind area.
Mm. I know, man. That's like very interesting. Like, I would never think that like a therapist would tell me to go get a massage, and right. I really experience that and be in that moment. And then when they come back to you, like, process it, like you guys talk about it, and like what did it feel like, and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And we're kind of like, what are some common like reactions to that?
Well, when I bring it up the first time, the common reaction is F you. Like, no, man, I'm not, and especially the small spoon, right?
Yeah.
Being vulnerable to your woman, it's no, I'm not going to do that. I'm here to protect. Yeah. Well, that's cool, but in your intimate relationships, you have to have that vulnerability in order to be healthy in the relationship. Because that's how, through attachment theory, as kids, that's part of what we struggle with in our adult relationships, is we never learned how to have that secure attachment. And so we're going back and learning that secure attachment through that process of snuggling or small spoon or massage, just because we're letting somebody into our space and touching us. And we talk about what it feels like, and then following up, we have this ongoing conversation about how did your body react when you got mad because somebody cut you off? What did your body do? And most people want to just focus on that anger piece. They want to get mad. It's like, no, put that aside. I know you're angry. That's cool. Whatever. And anger is a secondary emotion. So we got to have the foundation emotion, which is normally fear, right?
Yeah.
Or hurt or whatever emotion that's prominent at the time. But anger's secondary. So let's go back and look at what your body was doing. What did your chest get tight? Did your shoulders lock up? Did your neck start to hurt? That type of thing.
That's crazy. So what you're saying is like trauma lives inside of our Like bones, would you say?
Oh, it lives our entire body. It stays with us. Once you experience it, your body will keep the score. And that's a book.
Yeah. Body keeps the score.
Body keeps the score, yep. And so I use that book a lot. My book, it looks like a porcupine. I've got so many tabs stuck in there for points. Yeah, you saw it at the at the presentation.
Yeah.
So it absolutely keeps us track of all the trauma that you go through. And it's all manifested in a different way individually, but it still comes out physiologically and mentally. And so, like, one of the biggest things, examples I have is the vagus nerve complex. So the vagus nerve starts in your brainstem, and it's basically entrance to exit, right? Uh-huh. You're connected from your mouth to your butthole with the vagus nerve and all the stuff in between. So anybody that's been around young horses or wild horses, if you walk into a corral with a young horse, the first thing that young horse does is take a shit. Because instinctually, the lightest animal can run faster and farther.
Mm-hmm.
So the anxiety of you entering that place causes that horse to crap because it's getting ready to flee or fight.
Mm-hmm.
And so in humans, the same thing. If you get scared, if I scared the shit out of you, literally, it can happen because you get so scared that your body will void just to get ready to do whatever you're going to do. So, sometimes people's throats get tight, they get dry, your breathing gets shallow.
Horse, yeah.
Yeah. So your stomach starts to hurt. If you think about people that get really anxious and they always got a stomach ache or low back pain, they get diarrhea. Sometimes they get constipated. So it's all connected, and that's your body displaying those physiological responses to that trauma.
It's funny that you say that because, like, as kids, one of our favorite things to do was, like, to run from the cops. Yeah. And we always used to have, like, one of our friends, man, it didn't matter. Like, every single time he would stop and use the piss.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, in the middle of, like before it happened,
mm-hmm.
wait. And he'd use the piss, and then we'd, you know, chuck a bottle or something.
Yep.
And get chased. But, yeah, no, that's crazy.
Hmm. So that really, like what you guys were talking about there, like your body keeps the score. So that really plays into like the intergenerational trauma, epigenetics. You touch on that stuff.
Okay. Yeah. So when I first started getting into the historical trauma piece, I didn't. What interested me the most is I felt certain ways about things, and I never understood why.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started learning about the historical trauma, intergenerational trauma, and it was passed down, and I mean now they've got proof that it's passed down through your genes, for Native people. We all experienced the historical trauma, and it's not only just ingrained in our body, but it's also how we're taught.
Mm-hmm.
So you think about like a lot of the elders that we might have been around and their thinking and their thought process of, you know, don't trust anybody outside of the res, mm-hmm. that type of thought process and how we are taught to even start to hate our own people.
Mm-hmm.
And so we see a lot of the lateral violence come out. You know, we're attacking what we feel is the not what we feel, but what we've been told is the enemy, people mm-hmm. that look like us. So, mm-hmm. and you know, I can attack you, and that's okay because I'm doing it to keep, you know, me safe and to feel better.
Yeah.
And so when we see that connection, then that automatically seems to connect to a lot of the substance abuse and the high risk behaviors we see on the res now. And I think also it goes back to some of our societies. You know, we're geared and built to get to this point where we go out and do a ceremony or a quest to prove that we're ready to be men. And when you take away that ceremonial piece that helps guide those young men, they start to look at those high-risk behaviors. Well, stealing somebody's horse now is stealing a car.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, But the dangerous part is that we are going with these high risk behaviors, but we're so wrapped up in the self-hatred of, you know, who we are and as a people, mm-hmm. that we're taking drugs and drinking before we go steal that car.
Yeah.
So now we just compounded all of that legal system on top of us, not to mention the risk of death and harm to others.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I see, I had this conversation a few years ago with another individual who was like in and out, you know, through the system, you know, getting incarcerated, pre-release and come back out. And like, he's like, I'm in an identity crisis, you know? And he said, that's what I see with a lot of the brothers that are in, like, we're in an identity crisis. You know, like, how much do you see of that in your counseling and like, just like in your own personal life, I guess, with even like your own relatives that are caught up?
Yeah, that's huge. I mean, you know, our language is so expressive that mm-hmm. the translation to English doesn't work for a lot of our languages. So when we are connected to our language and our name is our identity, right? Mm-hmm. Who we are is our language and our name. That's what connects us as a people. And we take away spoken and understood language. What do we have a whole generations of, mm-hmm. of people that don't have an identity.
Mm.
You know, and so for me personally, I walked a long time not having a connection to my people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I see that a lot with my clients that I work with. And it's not interesting enough, it's not just the native population.
Mm.
So I was working with a guy that was a mixed race, black and white European race, and he never was able to identify either way, you know, because he's mixed race.
Yeah.
And he never had any connection with the black side of his family, the culture of the black side of his family. So he didn't understand a lot of the feelings he was having or you know, the way his hair grew and the way, you know, his body reacted to certain things. And once we took a moment and stepped back and started to look at the cultural impacts that he was missing,
mm-hmm.
he started to do better.
Mm.
You know, he was able to identify both sides, and at the end of it, we had had the opportunity for him to really develop an identity and become comfortable with self by looking at both sides.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's huge. It's incredibly important.
Yeah. And I know that's what I really appreciate about like the Wellbriety movement. You know, it's intertribal and has all these teachings from numerous tribes, like almost probably I'd say every tribe.
Intertribal.
North America.
Yeah.
All the tribes in North Dakota.
But it's like intertribal. I mean, like, because all these teachings are brought together and they got this curriculum and it's just the 12 steps and then their daily meditations with Native American elders. I love that. You know, I read it every day and it's just like, oh, okay, like, That helps with my identity. Like, okay, this is what my ancestors did.
Mm-hmm,
you know, they lived out the 12 steps of recovery every day. Because, like, 12 steps of recovery call you to accountability, transparency, community, and service work. And that's what our people did daily.
Mm-hmm,
you know, on the daily. That was their life. And so to take these teachings and then... And I was talking to you earlier before we got on air, like how when I read the Red Road to Wellbriety book, I was like, dang, this is what's going to work for me. Yeah. I was like, finally, you know, something that's going to work for me. And so I know that as I started my journey on Red Road, there were certain things that really worked, you know, like task work or, you know, some stuff from my treatment plan when I was in treatment that I continued to do, such as, you know, taking an honest look at yourself, writing out like obstacles and then like, are they real or are they made up in my mind?
Right.
You know, like those type of task works. Can you get into like some of those type of deals that you assign out to your clients that really work, especially like the Native men or Native population anyway?
I use it across all populations. Okay. You know? And so when our cultures, populations. So one of the things I really like is the medicine wheel and the concept of the medicine wheel, because you can use it in so many different areas. And I've got some worksheets and some assignments that we talk about what the medicine wheel means and what the directions mean. And then from there, we break it down into their situation.
Mm.
So if they're struggling with, and I'm an LCPC, so I don't have the alphabet soup to do the alcohol and drug addiction stuff.
Yeah.
But I'm working with people that have addiction that are seen in LAC.
Yeah.
So I do offer that collaborating support. So, you know, we always see a co-occurring issue.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll start to tear it down through that medicine wheel exercise. And at the end of it, they get to take their medicine wheel home with them, and it covers all the different aspects. And I actually brought an example of the medicine wheel that I use.
Okay.
And this is just an example of some of the stuff that we developed together. And we talk about what's in those, and for, you know, we don't have this on video, so it's a four-tiered medicine wheel design, and it covers all the different aspects of their life. And so we start to fill those things out as we explore who they are. The other part that I bring in is I use the seven sacred teachings. And again, you know, like you said, it's not for a single tribe or
and I
really make sure it's generalized for all of our people. But that crosses over to the being values, right? So if we talk about intrinsic or not intrinsic, but values or ethical values that we have, that's the seven sacred teachings. And it's very similar to what the Wellbriety path is, with, you know, the seven teachings. And so we sit down and talk about what each one means. You know, and the last one is I think truth is number seven, and that is represented by the turtle, because that's Mother Earth, right? The turtle. And it talks about the cycles and the moon cycles and women, which we all know are next to creator because she carries creation.
Yeah.
She doesn't create it, but she carries it. Mm-hmm. And so she should be, you know, in that same position, you know, creator then woman, and we honor them. And when we get to that point, I see a lot of people coming to that awareness and understanding of self. And then and then they create their own value system with medicine wheel exercise. So, and that's really, it doesn't matter, like I said, I've had a lot of non-native people that really connected to it, because it's about self-reflection, you know, starting with the foundation all the way up to self-actualization, which if you study Maslow's hierarchy, that's exactly what you're going for, is that top piece is the self-actualization. And interesting enough, Maslow, everybody calls it a pyramid. It's actually based off of the teepee. So he was working with some First Nations folks when he was going through all this process. And it's actually based off of teepees instead of the pyramid, which is cool. So it's even a stronger connection for us because it was based off our people.
Right on, man. That's pretty good. Pretty good. What about favorite Indian or pot god? You guys got any more questions for?
I was just going to say, so you talked about that generational trauma and, you know, it being, I guess, in the RNA is what they said. I can't remember. But anyway, so with that trauma part of it being a part of, you know, kind of what makes us tick, I was just wondering if you saw anything that would say that like, okay, so some of our cultural teachings and some of our, you know, we're talking about identity, like if some of that good stuff is still there too, like if you started talking about the medicine wheel to somebody who was, you know, in a funk or whatever, like things just kind of click almost, we intrinsically know certain things, right? Like, because I, like, looking back, growing up, there were things that I was never told, like, you know, you don't interrupt your elders, you know, we have respect, you know, for certain things, certain ways to hold yourself around in, during ceremonies or whatever. And I don't ever remember people saying, okay, this is exactly what you have to do. We just kind of knew that. Right. But I guess what, you know, the short version of that is, have you seen that good stuff too come through? Like, just kind of like it's always been there. We just got to dig that out too.
Yeah. So I really hate the word resiliency and resilient. I do not like that word when it's describing our people, because it, to me, it's just a justification. All right. And I don't like that. So I do look at, you know, our ability to be here and stay here and survive. That's what resiliency means. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And when we're doing this work with the wheels, it's all about balance in our life. Everything is about balance in our circle and making sure it's still in center and we're going forward in a good way. And with that has to be good things. And so a lot of times I'll see people, when we're working on the wheel, they'll have like this moment of like clarity and go, oh, I didn't even know that was there. I didn't know I did those things. Because it's society as a whole, and I'm probably going to get, beat up on this one, but society as a whole focuses only on negative.
Mm.
So anytime we enter into a therapeutic intervention or therapeutic relationship, there's nothing that's focusing on the person's goodness that when they come to me, you know, so I don't even read like referral information until after I meet the client, because I don't want a preconceived notion of what that individual's coming
kind of
to me for.
Bias, huh?
Yeah. I don't want the bias at all. So I just take a person as a fresh person. When they sit down with me, after we do the intake, I'll read through the information that's sent to me to help with the diagnosis, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So as we go through that whole process, we absolutely pull up those positive things that get buried by all the things that we're told we're bad with, because our focus is always shifted onto the negative. And so, yeah, I see a lot of people have all these good traits, and nobody ever acknowledges it until we get into a exercise where we're focusing on balance and values and the person as an individual. So it's still there and we all have it. It's just a matter of being able to recognize it and then foster it.
Mm. So do you think that kind of goes back to like, we'll use me as an example, like my belief system as far as like, say, low self-worth, low self-esteem, like never thinking, okay, well, I can't be good because I'm bad. Like, so, like, if I'm focused on this wall, that's what I'm looking at. But you can turn around and say, okay, there's a whole other wall on this side, right?
Right.
So that's kind of...
It's exactly what it is. You know, we get... So none of us are born bad.
Mm-hmm.
When you're a baby, you're born pure. There might be only, like, one or two people we've seen in history that are truly bad. Charles Manson, that dude was bad. Like, you watch videos of his interviews and stuff, there's nothing in his eyes.
Yeah, it's flat. Crazy.
And so I believe that guy was born bad from the word go. But the rest, you know, most of the people, we're not bad. We are taught to be hateful of self. Mm. We are taught all of these maladaptive coping skills just to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you go into a room and if you're told, I want you to find all the red squares, right?
Yeah.
You won't pay attention to the black squares. You'll focus on just the red ones. And it's the same thing. If we're focusing on negative thoughts and negativity, your whole life, you're going to find, I guarantee it, you'll find all the negative stuff. But if you stop and step back for a minute and start to look at the positives and have some gratitude and be grateful for your opportunities that are presented, you'll start to see all the goodness that's coming forward. And you're absolutely right. The self-hatred part, you know, I still, to this day, when I wake up in the morning, I tell myself I'm a good dad, I'm a good husband,
yep,
and I'm a good person, because I don't believe it. I don't believe it.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's one thing that I still struggle with, like that defeating belief that I'm not good enough. You know, yeah, like I... still weekly got to tell myself, you know, like, hey, you're good enough. You know, like standing in front of the mirror, you're good enough. You're good enough to have this job. You're good enough to wear those clothes. Mm-hmm. You're good enough to be on this podcast. So things like that. Because it's so ingrained in me, you know.
You want to hear the worst assignment I was ever given in therapy?
What's that?
I had to look in the mirror and say, I love you.
Mm.
Come on.
Yeah.
You know how long it took me?
How long did it take you?
3 months. I quit using my bathroom. I'd piss outside because we had a huge mirror at that time. I quit showering. I showered at work because we had a shower at work. Yeah, I quit using the bathroom. I pissed outside. I'd shower at work. Dang. Brush my teeth in the kitchen.
To avoid that.
To avoid saying that I love me because I didn't believe it.
So with all that, like, with all that being said, I think it's a perfect segue. Like, what is one thing that you've learned in your profession that you wish that everybody would take? Like one piece of advice or one lesson that everybody should learn?
It's all fixable.
Hmm.
You can screw up. It's okay. We can fix it. And until the point where you quit and fail, by meaning you quit trying and you are no longer walking with us, right? You can fix it. And that's what the suicidal ideation, that's what I'm working on every day with me too. Mm-hmm. You know, why do I stay here? Well, my daughter, my wife, my family, you know, those are the reasons I do this. In my story, every time I tell my story, I hope somebody's impacted and feels like a connection and they're like, oh, okay, I get it. You know, it's fixable. We can take this and we can look at it and we can figure out a way to get around it. We can process through it. Never goes away, but I can absolutely help you learn how to manage it.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's manageable.
Definitely. So I got a question. Like, so I've come across individuals like that, you know, they're on the fence or just like totally against counseling. Because then they're like, well, I don't want to be all drugged up and just like a zombie and blah, blah, blah. And that's kind of their rant. Or they're like, I don't want to go talk to somebody and, you know, I'm good and blah, blah, blah. But they clearly need that, you know, the counseling, the therapy. What would you say to them? Like, well, like they're listening to this. What would you say?
Those are actually like my favorite clients.
All right, right on.
I love those guys, and I love especially like the rancher, the old rancher type, the cowboys and the, you know, the guys, the tough guys that don't like therapy. They don't, you know, head shrinks and quacks.
Yeah,
you know, pretty much like my dad. Like, you know, he always said that stuff. And even after I got my degree, he'd be like, "Oh, they're just quacks." I'm like, "Thanks, man. Thanks for that."
Thanks, pops.
Yeah, way to encourage me. So with those people. The thing I start to talk about with them is comfort.
Mm.
You're comfortable in the cesspool. And they're like, no, I'm not. I don't like it. I said, no, it's not that you like it. You're comfortable. You know what to expect next. And when you're successful, when you're stepping out of that chaos, you don't know what's going to happen next. You don't know what good means. What success means. Mm. What does that look like? You know, and I learned that from a domestic violence group. These group of ladies let me sit in and they, you know, gave me permission to participate. And I just sat there and listened. And it was amazing what these ladies were talking about. Mm. You know, one lady, she finally decided it was enough when her husband beat her with a baseball bat and gave her a closed head trauma. Jeez. Broke her eye sockets, and she's like, okay, I'm done. Yeah. And I was like, wow. Like, we went to that point? Like, you know, maybe the first time you got punched and knocked out? No, not a sign? Done. And she's like, no, because it's the morning after. You're a princess. You get everything you want. So it really fills that need of you know, being loved and supported and cared for.
Mm.
And that's what they all talked about. So I took that and kind of twisted that into, like, trauma and you know, drug and alcohol abuse or resistance to therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're looking at is that comfort level. You know that if you have a mental breakdown tomorrow, a psychotic event, that there's these steps that are going to be taken to help keep you safe. But if you don't have that tomorrow and you get a full-time job and you start to take care of yourself, what does that look like?
Yeah.
And that's what we also see that in like relationships too. People are self-sabotaging. You know, I'm feeling secure. I'm feeling loved. I have to do something because I'm so uncomfortable. I don't know what to expect. So I'm going to go cheat. I'm going to get drunk and cheat. I'm going to, you know, steal some money or whatever that trigger is or activating event that they do.
Yeah.
So with those people, we have a conversation about you're comfortable. And that really usually fires people up pretty good. No, I hate it. Well, I get it. You can hate it, but you're still comfortable.
Yeah.
You know, cognitive dissonance is what's created. So when the brain starts to not understand, you know, the situation and the feelings, you got to have that disturbance until that person becomes so uncomfortable in their comfortable place that they change. Mm.
So basically it's like saying the fear of the unknown. Like right. you, I don't know what success looks like. I don't know what it's like to be sober. I don't know what it's like to be a good dad. I don't know what it's like to do any of those things. But I know what it's like to drink and use and run around and, you know, not be responsible and all that other, and, you know, all the chaos that comes with it. Because I know what it is.
And it's what we've been taught by everybody before us.
Yeah.
We accept it. So when I became the liaison counselor, at one point, I looked at an FBI study. And out of the senior graduating girls, 98% had had sexual assault, rape, abuse out of the graduating senior class. Mm. Of that 98%, 92% of them, it was a familial male that did it.
Mm.
So a dad, an uncle, a brother, a cousin was never and still isn't addressed on a lot of our reservations. Why? We sit in this room and we say it's a horrible thing. That's not okay. And it's not okay because we're supposed to respect and honor our women. But then when we go home, it's never talked about. It's accepted because everybody's comfortable with that status quo. So what is that imaginary line on the reservation border? What's the difference? What power does it have? Why does it keep it real and not real, or accepted and unaccepted?
Yeah. that's a tough one.
That's crazy.
Yeah, that is crazy. That's just like, really gets my wheels spinning, like, as far as, like, how can we, like, help, you know, help in that situation, you know?
Talk.
Yeah.
And pray that everything in the dark comes to the light.
Wow. Yeah, and I think that kind of falls right in line with, like, one thing that we're always kind of talking about on here is, like, for, like, especially, like, on the reservation, there needs to be a great healing. A great healing that needs to take place, like, everybody involved actively, like, working on themselves to be better. In order for, like, our people, especially, yeah, like, on the reservation to move forward in a good way, to prosper, that I just gets my mind, my wheels rolling, like, need to help facilitate or foster that somehow, this great healing that we can bring stuff like this to the table.
You know, our old ways, we had ceremonies for all this stuff. And when we stepped away from the ceremonies, we stepped away from healing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and of course, that's part of why it was banned and made illegal and, and all that fun stuff, because they knew it was powerful. And I think a lot of our generations now, we talk about traditions, we talk about our ways, but we don't believe that it's true, you know. Like when I was out with the Northern Cheyenne, I was adopted into a Northern Cheyenne family, and we talked about sweet medicine. and what that prophet did for the Northern Cheyenne people. Mm. And the individual that was working with me and kind of teaching me some of the ways was very adamant that this is real, and the power that's there is real, because everybody else around wasn't believing it when we'd talk about it. That's just, you know, it's good to have those beliefs and to have that thought just in case.
Yeah.
And this individual is like, there's no in case. Like, this shit's real.
Yeah.
And it'll get Western if you don't follow it. So.
Wow. You guys have any thoughts or questions?
No, I was just thinking about, you know, what going along with what you just now said, just and going back to that identity part, you know, growing up, I always think, you know, I know what it's like to be Indian. I grew up on the res, you know, I put on my regalia.
That's costume?
That's the one I hate, is regalia. Yeah. I can't stand that word. But, you know, so I know what it's like to be, I know what it's like to be Native. But I didn't, like, because really, what does that look like? It wasn't what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
It sure as hell wasn't what I was doing.
Right.
And then, you know, going back to the beginning of my walk on the Red Road, it was that spirituality. It was that culture, that those sweat lodge and all that kind of stuff. That really, that was my foundation. That was what I grounded myself in. And then that's when I started to, you know, realize and, you know, kind of understand, like, I wasn't living Indian. I was playing Indian.
Right.
Kind of the opposite of what's his name said?
Little Big Man?
Little Big Man. I wasn't just playing Indian. I was living Indian.
Yeah.
Right. But it was the opposite, right?
Right.
Mm.
So when I was growing up, my dad's white. My mom's Native and white, so it's mixed. And my dad would always say, you know, don't act like a snot-nosed Indian. Act like a white man when I was a kid. And so that, along the same lines, like, I was always going away from my people instead of going towards them. And I remember going to school, because Cutbank's a border town, and I'd go to school, and I was a res rat, you know. I was one of those res rats from Seville Flats.
Yeah.
Mm.
You know, and then I'd go home, and all the other Native kids around would be, you know, they'd call me an Apple Indian, you know, because I went to the white, you know, school off the res. And so walking that line, trying to figure out who the hell I was, you know.
Yeah.
And then, you know, knowing that we have this rich history, but then told I couldn't go look at it or learn it or be a part of it. So when I finally got, you know, out on my own and I was doing my own thing, I just kept getting pulled back. Just, I could feel it pull back.
Yeah.
And so I started, that's where I got into the liaison work. And then I became a tribal director. And then I became a consultant for another TAC group. And every time I would leave, I just start to, you know, just have this urge to go back. Mm. And I'd sit in all these white state and federal meetings and just, oh my God, I just want to stab myself in the eye with a pencil. It's so dry, and they just sit there and talk for hours about the same shit. And it's like, no.
Never doing anything.
No, yeah, just same thing over and over. And then you'd go to like a Native group like KNAR, Consortium of Administrators for Native American Rehab. It's a national organization for the tribal VR programs. But you'd go to KNAR, and geez, everybody would be laughing, and you'd be having a good time and joke, you know, Indian humor, right?
Yeah.
Kind of like the way you guys start off your podcast, and that's I really enjoy that. And so they'd pull me back, and it's even now to where, as the director of the AVERTAC, I have people reaching out to me saying, hey, you need to go to these other federal agencies and do presentations so we can actually learn something and stay awake,
you know,
because, and anyway, so that always kept pulling me back. And then I started asking people and interacting with the right people, you know, the elders and the ceremonial people and stuff like that. And that's where all of my connections started. And, you know, like I shook the hand of an elder one time, and it was, you know, you do the respectful, like half squeeze, you know, you don't want to, you know, be disrespectful of the elder.
Yeah.
And he latched onto me and he wouldn't let go. Mm. It was like uncomfortable. You know, you shake somebody's hand, it's like, 3 second rule, get off me. Yeah. And this dude wouldn't let go. Like, he just kept holding on to me and holding on to me, and he kept looking at me, and I was starting to get really uncomfortable because he was doing that soul stare, you know, just kind of going right into you. And he goes, you have it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, I don't. I don't have anything. He's like, you have it. You carry the medicine in you.
Mm.
And I was like, holy, you know, shit, what does that mean? So then I went back and talked to a healer back in the community, and we started exploring all that stuff. And I think that's part of, you know, my success with individual therapy and working with the people I work with, with the traumas that I work with. I think that's part of the medicine I carry.
Oh yeah,
is that I can work in that field and not just, you know, lay in the corner, puddle up, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's real.
Oh yeah,
and that's real.
Yeah.
No, I definitely like when I went to that conference or that workshop that we were at, and you're the presenter. I definitely felt like a connection right away. I was like, boom, this kid knows it. Like, you know what you're talking about. You know, like you're the healer. Like, I felt that energy while I was there, and I felt like welcome. And like, normally, like when I go to those things, I just sit back and chill and like, you know, participate and stuff, but don't really like, you know, jump up and grab the mic or whatever. I just want to take it in because I do enough presentations and talking in my own, you know, career and stuff. So I try to just sit back. But there, I was just like, man, I was like, it was a good vibe. And I was just like, boom. And he broke us up into those groups and said, we need a spokesperson. And I grabbed that mic. I said, I'll do it. Just jumped up, started talking. Because it was like welcoming. It was like the same type of flow, you know?
Yeah.
And definitely, I picked up on that right away.
That was good to hear.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that's what I try and do. I mean, you know, because I want people to be welcome. I mean, how else are we going to get this done? And that training was really awesome because we had a bunch of non-native people in there that, I think they learned a lot about our culture.
And law enforcement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I hope they learned something.
They were sitting in the back.
In the back. with their guns. So, I didn't really want to challenge them because I thought they might shoot me. But
I'm just kidding. Should have got up all up in them.
I'm glad that that's what it felt like in that room.
Yeah, definitely.
Even with the challenges, huh?
Yeah.
You remember?
that's how it goes, though, man. Yeah. That's how it goes, man. Like, you have an event, and you can plan for, it's like the Outcast saying, you can plan a pretty picnic, but you can't predict the weather.
Yeah.
I mean, so you just got to go with the flow. You guys have any more comments, questions, or anything for?
No, I mean.
The bringer of sausage?
Wish we could get.
the meat sausage, man.
The sausage bringer.
sausage bringer.
I guess I would ask, like, what 3 books would you encourage the listeners to read?
Mm.
Oh, that's a good one. Body Keeps the Score, right off the top.
Okay.
That's all about trauma, and that's, you know, my deal. The second book is Legacy. By Suzanne Methot. She's a First Nations lady, and it talks, I mean, it's firsthand Native trauma, right? Mm. So when she goes through it, I got just as many porcupine stickers in that book as I do in the other book about trauma.
I have that book. It was given to me and I've never read it.
Oh man, crack it open. Okay. It's an eye opener. And then the third one is with Don Coyas.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Native Leadership book, the 10 Scrolls.
Yeah, that's
love that one. Man. Love that. I read that. I just got in reading it again.
Nice.
Because I, you know, I'm in a leadership role as a director of AVERTAC, so I really try and follow the teachings of what I expect my people to do with the programs that we're working with.
Yeah, definitely.
So, yeah, what's, those 3.
What's Legacy? Who's that? Who's the author?
Suzanne Methot.
Okay.
It's Methot. It's Legacy, and I mean, there's a bunch of little words underneath it, but the big one's Legacy.
Okay.
Actually, I got a picture here.
Yeah, no, I have both of those 2 last ones, so I'm definitely in the
Native Leadership.
Popping open, yeah, that. Both books were gifted to me like a few years ago, and I've never opened them.
Yeah, crack them open, man.
Like if it was a, what's it, graphic novel, they would have been read by now.
Yeah. graphic novel?
Yeah, that was comic book.
I'm no, a like, comic book guy. This whole conversation just makes me think about a book that's laying on my lampstand in my living room. It's kind of laying under there. but it's along the lines of what's the body keeps a score, and it's called My Grandmother's Hands, and the therapist's name is Resma Menekin. But yeah, it kind of talks about like the whole trauma being in your bones and exercises in there, you know, like how to, you know, to feel that stuff. So I really appreciate that, man. Thank you.
The Body Keeps the Score has a workbook with it too.
Yeah.
And that workbook is pretty cool. And right at the beginning it says do it on a separate piece of paper so that you can go back and do it again. And that way you can track your growth as you process through some of that trauma.
Okay.
I know.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
I know. Well, I would say you're officially off the hot seat. So good job. Let's give him some Lulus and some hand claps here. We need a war cry.
We need a war cry. Oh, there you go. We got our guy right here.
Ah-hoo! So, yeah, that was a really good session on the hot seat. I'm going to open it up to you. I'm going to throw it over to you, Wayne, if you have any questions for us. As for anything.
How can I help you guys get this out?
Man, just take us with you. Meaning, like, wherever you go, like, just bring us up, man. We got a box of cards over there. You can take that wherever you go. It's like, hey, check these guys out. Boom, 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 boom. I think, because, you know, the Moccasin Telegraph works way better than any other source of, information?
Yeah.
Like, you know, we post constantly, but it's always word of mouth, you know, that works best. Because I run into listeners on my travels and stuff, and they're like, oh, yeah, my counselor told me about you guys. Or, oh, this, you know, my cousin told me about you guys, and I started listening. I listened to every episode, man. We can't wait for Thursdays, you know. And they go off, but it always starts out with someone told me about you guys.
Yeah.
You know. So okay. that's the key right there, man. So take us with you.
Yes.
Cool.
Yeah. Uh-oh.
Any more questions?
No.
Not good. You guys have anything else?
Charlie.
Holmes.
Charlie. No, just thanks for coming in again. You know, man, I wish we could sit here and pick your brain all night, but we got lives other than this podcast.
Yeah, definitely. So, yeah, we'll have you back again, you know, as a co-host. You don't have to be on the hot seat. We'll just pick a topic and we'll go.
Okay, cool. Yeah I'd love to do that.
Yeah,
definitely. Chair is always open. Come back anytime.
Cool.
All right, so someone listened to this podcast, and they're like, man, I need to get in contact with Mr. Dago. How do they go about doing that?
Yeah, I'm on Psychology Today.
Okay.
You can look me up on Psychology Today. Otherwise, it's it's my name, Wayne, at perspectivescounseling.org.
Okay. Right on.
So you
heard it here first. This is how you get a hold of the bringer of sausage.
Yeah, the sausage bringer.
Packing that wild meat. Everywhere he goes.
All right. Yeah, I think that's a good place to wrap it up. And to
wrap up that spicy meat. Yeah.
We're not going there tonight.
Oh, okay. We unwrapped it. Now wrap it up.
Oh, man. All right. So, to all our listeners underneath the firmament, we love you. We appreciate you. And to our unspoken words disciples, keep spreading unspoken words gospel, Billy Graham style. Hey.
Oh.
All right. Until next time, Shinnick.
Peace.
Deuce.
These unspoken words I'm trying to get out my head. Plug in the mic and leave nothing unsaid. Now sit back, relax, and listen to some real talk.